It is Friday and time to exhale. Settle in for some conversation as well. I'm Rhonda McBride, and coming up on Juno Afternoon, Healing the Future by Healing the Past, a look at the history behind the building that now houses the Juno Montessori School. Also a first for Juno, a series of fall concerts from Juno Jazz and Classics. And we'll spotlight a few of the birds of Juno. As far as bird watching weather, well, we had a break in the rain today with some sunshine, but you should be prepared for rain tonight. Tomorrow, cloudy skies, scattered showers. Sunday looks promising with another day of cloudy skies, but always a chance of rain, a pattern that's in the forecast through Tuesday. Juno Afternoon, we'll be right back after National Native News. Thank you for being here with us today on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. That famous Southern novelist William Faulkner summed it up pretty well. He said, "The past is never dead, it's not even over, and yet sometimes history for some groups of people gets erased. For others, if the past is traumatic, it can live on in harmful ways." Think about Juno, for example. The mountains, the lakes, they all once had names in Tlingit, but those got erased as miners and other newcomers came and gave everything new names. Well, there's one chapter of Juno history that several groups would like to bring back into focus, the history of the Mayflower School, nestled on St. Anne's Avenue near downtown Douglas. It now houses the Juno Montessori School, but between 1934 and 1940, the Bureau of Indian Affairs ran the school. And there are now efforts to reacquaint the community with the school's history, but be forewarned, while the building looks charming, it has neither a pretty nor romantic history. And joining us to talk about that and the Orange Shirt Day event on September 30th to raise awareness about boarding schools, we have Jamie Ann Hasselquist. She is the Vice President of the Alaska Native Sisterhood. We have Laura Talpe, Executive Director of the Juno Montessori School, and Ati Nisaya, who is the Violence Prevention Director at AWARE. And I thought we would begin with you, Jamie Ann, about why you think it's so important that the community learn the history of the Mayflower School.
Goodness, Chish. Tlingit Kena Zechtin Aya Achsai. My Tlingit name is Zechtin, and my colonial name is Jamie Ann Hasselquist. Thank you for having us on today. I think it's very important that our community members learn about the history of the what is now known as the Juno Montessori School. It was the Mayflower School that served as a place of assimilation and was exclusively for Native children from 1936 to 1940, as you had mentioned. And it's just a part of our healing process to be able to bring these things into awareness for our community, because when we are silent and don't speak about things, it just becomes more harmful to us. When we begin the conversation, then the healing can begin for us as Indigenous people, but also for the entire community, because we did not get to this place by ourselves. So we ask that people join in on this conversation to bring more awareness of the assimilation process through the boarding school institutions and also day schools.
Well, the boarding school experience periodically comes in and out of the public consciousness, but recently revelations in Canada about the abuses there and the mass graves of Indigenous children have brought the issue back. And I want to go to Ati Nisaya, who's the Violence Prevention Director at AWARE. When things are buried and the history isn't acknowledged, how does it harm people? Because, you know, a lot of people would say the past is past. It really has nothing to do with today. But what's your response to that?
Ganesh Chish, what a powerful question. I think, you know, each of us, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and each of us has work to do in locating the histories of our ancestors and exploring the traumas of either being a settler colonizer and being a part of harm doing, or experiencing the resilience and trauma within the body of having endured that violence. Each of us, we have those ancestors and we have those experiences, and they reside in our hearts, they reside in ourselves, and they reside in our worldviews. Unfortunately, colonization has worked to erase worldviews, language, culture, families. And so as we're reckoning with issues today around suicide, mental health and wellness, domestic violence and sexual assault, embedded within the frameworks of capitalism and patriarchy and colonization, is this these wounds that long for healing. And so I think the invitation that we're holding in our hearts and in our bodies is to reckon with the truth of our pasts and to deepen into the healing opportunities that we have when we work to bring forth and listen deeply to the wisdom of those worldviews that were so deeply hurt and harmed through colonization. There's so much that we have to learn from brilliant and beautiful indigenous leaders like Jamie Ann and so many others across the community who invite us with such grace and love to be healed by these beautiful values of lifting each other and loving, leading with love. And so I see this really as an opportunity for us to heal together through reckoning with the truth of our histories, and through that finding good paths forward so that we can bring these children home, so that we can revitalize languages that were nearly lost, so that we can really strive to be in right and good relationship with ourselves and each other and Tlingit Ani.
So I'm going to go back to you, Jamie Ann. Can you talk a little bit about the history so we can appreciate how the children suffered? Because a lot of people think, well, you know, it couldn't have been that bad. But was it?
Oh, yes, definitely was very bad. Through the institution era, we had these flagship schools. So Carlisle Institute, institution is in Pennsylvania, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. They were the flagship school to this boarding school assimilation process. And they began around 1888. And the Sheldon Jackson Institute in Sitka, Alaska, was in partnership with Carlisle Institute. And they opened in 1889. Throughout this process of my own research, I have stumbled upon letters from Richard H. Pratt, whose motto was to kill the Indian, save the man, and letters written from him to Sheldon Jackson School, ordering 50 more Kelsey Blue suits, little army suits, to be made in smaller sizes for Sheldon Jackson. So the assimilation process started quite early for us. And I think as Indigenous people of Alaska, we don't really realize exactly how assimilated and how forceful it was compared to Plains Indians, but it was very equal. The thing was that we as Native people were in the way of their industrialization. They wanted to get into the resources. They wanted to get into the land. They wanted to get the trees, the fish, the furs. And we as Native people, we honored our land and we still do to this day. We are the caretakers, right? We wouldn't have allowed those sorts of things to happen to our land without our perception of reality being changed. And so these institutions were to change our perceptions of reality. It was very forceful. There was mental abuse, sexual abuse, narcissistic and emotional abuse. And those things that were experienced in these institutions came home with survivors. And this ripple effect continues today. And it was not that long ago. The last institution closed around 1976, I believe. I was 4 years old and so very close to being taken away to one of these institutions. In Canada, they closed in 1996. And so while I was in college, even, there were still these forceful institutions happening, which we call boarding schools. But I always tend to add on the word institution because these so-called schools have cemeteries at them. And I don't know about your school, but the public schools that I went to didn't have cemeteries at them.
No. And do we have elders who are still around that went to that school? And what are their stories? What do we know about what they experienced?
Oh, we definitely do have survivors of that school still here with us today. We have heard some of their stories. However, they are not mine to tell. But I can say that the stories of the institution era echo throughout the community. And I get the answer. There's good memories and there's bad memories. We survived. And that seems to be an answer that I hear over and over. Some people will open up and tell about some of the experiences that they have endured from when they were caught speaking the Tlingit language and how forceful the adults were, violently forceful, putting soap in their mouths, chemicals in their mouths, grabbing them by the hair, shouting at them very loudly in violent manners, a lot of abuse. And the day school, as opposed to a boarding school institution, the only difference is that children went home at the end of the day. They still endured the same abuse as they did in a residential institution.
And that sense of otherness, that they weren't going to school with the other children in the community. Well, I want to turn to Laura Talpe. I wanted to ask you about how the school is handling this history, because these things happened long before the Juneau Montessori School came to pass. And in fact, the founder of the school, that school system, was very child-friendly, very much about respecting children. So how are you handling this? Are you going to be talking to the children about this, or are they just too young? How is this acknowledgement taking place?
Yeah, I think it has been and will continue to be a very long road for us. A big part of what we are doing right now as the school community is just educating ourselves, learning more about the history of our building that we now inhabit, learning more about the history of what happened in the Juneau Douglas area. To answer your question about how we're working with the children in age or younger. So they're not quite developmentally ready to talk about things like abuse, but we are starting to, and we are going to continue to build more culturally responsive education practices in our school, incorporate more place-based education practices into our school, and just try to represent the culture that we're part of here in Juneau Douglas and bring that into the lives of our children. That's so important, and that's a really important foundation for them.
And I would imagine that it's a very rich experience to bring to the children anyway. I mean, something as educators you would want to do.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Southeast Alaska is such a rich environment, and there is so much to be taught and so many fun things to do with young children just around Sandy Beach, things we can find. It's really fun to think about the ways that we can build culture into our education practices. And Maria Montessori was a huge part of her pedagogy. One of my favorite Maria Montessori quotes is, "An education capable of saving humanity is no small undertaking. It involves the spiritual development of man, the enhancement of his value as an individual, and the preparation of young people to understand the times in which they live." She was a big proponent of teaching children who they are, you know, helping them understand who they are and where they come from and their role in the society in which they live, which is often very localized. So that's what we aim to do with our children.
A lot of the thinking at that time was that the best hope for humanity was in the children. If you could save the children, you could save humanity. Ati, what do you think about that philosophy?
I think our children are precious, and that when we can love each other's children as fiercely as we love our own and ensure a community that is safe and well and is thriving, that we have well-resourced, profound, and brilliant leaders. And I feel so joyful that my daughter is attending the Juno Montessori School. And I feel so joyful around the reckoning that I'm witnessing the board and the director and lead teachers edging on around understanding the power of place and exploring how to become more actively anti-racist and inclusive of who they are and aren't serving. And I feel like the school is just edging on long overdue conversations within a building that has walls that have lived through tremendous harm and an opportunity to lean into rewriting a new narrative in a way that gives me a sense of hope and strength. And I was also just lingering on that question you had about how bad was it. And I just want to be honest, I was feeling some sacred rage in that there is so much evidence found in the fabric of a community when you look at whose children are being taken away and whose bodies are being assaulted and who is and isn't being protected. And so just wanting to continue to, for myself and others, to invite us to orient towards how we and the organizations that we serve can do the work of rewriting, right, these narratives that were really rooted in frameworks that were inherently violent and inherently intended to privilege and benefit some bodies at the expense of others. And so, Gunashish to the beautiful Black leaders of the nation, Gunashish to the Indigenous leaders who have been so brave to again and again lead us in a good path forward, where in 2021, it is no longer acceptable to run a school where we're teaching curriculum that erases the voices and narratives of our neighbors, especially those that were the original stewards of this land. And so I know for me, you know, working at AWARE and working with Hatush Luchish, there's just this ongoing invitation for myself and those organizations that I partner with around how do we reckon with the truth of the violence that we have inherited as a community, or as in connection to maybe a school like Laura or an organization, and how do we begin to be in right relationship so that we stop causing the violence and the harm of racism and sexism, and we begin loving through listening and centering relation.
So perhaps before we run out of time, we should talk about Orange Shirt Day, which is coming up on September 30th. And this is an event to raise awareness about the history and trauma from boarding schools. And Juno is going to have its own acknowledgement of that. Jamie Ann, can you tell us what's being organized?
Oh, yes, definitely. For those people who don't know what Orange Shirt Day is, excuse me, Orange Shirt Day is a day to raise awareness of the Indigenous children who were sent away to residential boarding school institutions in order to assimilate them. And this day is a day to promote community healing and to recognize the intergenerational traumas that are affecting us today. So next Thursday, September 30th, is the day for you to wear orange, the color orange. And we are going to start off the morning or the day with what's called a morning wave. So at 6:45 a.m. to 7:45 a.m., Gold Belt Incorporated has graciously sponsored our morning wave. So there's going to be some coffee and some pastries available for those of you who show up to the Mendenhall Wetlands, the little pullout after Sunny Point. So as you're driving to town, there's the little overview center there. And we're going to be there with our orange banner, wearing our orange colors. And I invite people to bring drums and their songs so that we can start our morning off that way. And we're just going to nicely wave at the vehicles as they go by to raise more awareness and get them to start asking, what are those people doing? And why are they all wearing orange? And then later that evening at 5:30 p.m., we're going to have an awareness rally at Anahia Andaganye, which is where the sun rays hit first. We know it by its English name of Sandy Beach. We will be at the Pioneer Pavilion. And so at 5:30 p.m., we're going to have an awareness rally with some presentations from community members. And we're just praying to the ancestors and the weather spirits that we have good weather. But we will also have some pop-up tents and things like that. So dress appropriately and wear your orange if you have it. However, there will be some shirts there as well for suggested donations. And we will talk about the Mayflower School, which was ran from the Boarding Bureau of Indian Affairs. We mentioned that. And we'll also talk about the place that we're standing in, which is Anahia Andaganye, and how it has received its name, Savico Park.
So many stories are intertwined there. Laura, I want to go to you and talk a little bit about how you plan to work with the parents of the children about this event and to acknowledge the school's history.
Yeah, a huge part of this is educating ourselves and helping to educate the community on what has happened here. So I think a big part of our role is trying to provide opportunities for families to engage in place-based education practices, to learn alongside us, and to come in and be part of their child's education. And Ati, you know, as a parent, she has brought Devil's Club into her child's classroom and herring eggs. And there are many delightful ways to share fun things with the children and start to build that foundation of understanding the land on which they live, Tlingit Ani, and then from there can better understand the history and their place in that society. So, you know, we're working with adults and we're working with children, and they're at different places with their education, but we're all kind of learning together.
So as far as all this acknowledgement that's happening involving the Mayflower School, which is now the Juno Montessori School, Ati, can you tell us how it's part of a bigger picture of what your coalition is trying to do with healing community-wide in many areas?
Also, I want to make sure that we don't lose sight of Alaska Native Sisterhood Camp 2 and their brave leadership in putting a spotlight on the importance of this day and this event. And particularly Vice President Jamie Ann has been a warrior, a brave warrior and truth teller. And so I just feel so blessed that I stumbled into Jamie Ann actually after Jamie Ann and other leaders came to Juno Montessori School and covered the school in prayers and flowers in the wake of the discovering of 215 children. We had beautiful leaders come and honor the grief within the walls of this building here on South Douglas and begin to bring some awareness and attention. And so I felt so grateful that after two nights of not sleeping and feeling and thinking, I was praying to my ancestors and I landed in a ceremony. I didn't know I was invited, but I was. And it was really a beautiful evening of a number of leaders that were there to honor those children and tie ribbons around South Douglas and pray and grieve and rage and mourn, but really to come back to a place of love. And so, you know, I work with Hattush Lachish. We are a community-based coalition that is dedicated to addressing issues of violence and really focusing on turning around these patterns of erasure and lifting up and listening. And but we are one small piece, and it's been so beautiful. Like, this project alone has been really fearlessly led by Camp 2, Gunashish, to Alaska Native Sisterhood for your ongoing historical role in anti-discrimination work, at Gold Belt Heritage, University of Alaska Southeast, Juno Montessori School, Gold Belt Foundation. Who else am I forgetting?
The Alaska Corporation and Tlingit and Haida Central Council.
So this is not about any single one of us. This is not about any one individual or any one organization. This is not even about our precious and sacred community. This is about a national movement that is so powerful. Our ancestors are guiding us as we reckon with these truths of harm and as we understand that we have responsibility collectively to transform violence and to heal and to create pathways so our precious children and all of our precious children can thrive and be free from violence and harm and have joy in their identity, the beauty of their identities. And so I just feel so honored that I've been able to build some trust and relation both with Laura and with Jamie Ann. And our work is long, and it's going to take all of us to blister our hands, and we've got a lot of good work to do, and it feels so good to do this work.
Jamie Ann, you should take the last words here. And to me, there is a sad part of this story, but there's a powerful part of this story that some of those elders who went to that school have been instrumental in making sure the language and culture were passed on, even though all those things happened to them as children that would have discouraged it. I mean, this really is a story about heroes and heroines, isn't it?
Oh, yes. The language bearers and the ones who held on to our stories of our clans, you know, when they came back, they did a lot of these things in secrecy. And in fact, they kept us children out of the loop because they didn't want us to go and speak the language and receive the harm that they did. And it's just until recently where we are starting to kind of figure out exactly what happened to us. and the younger generation is colonizing in many different ways on many different levels. And those precious gems, I call them, are, you know, they're in their years. My mother went to Sheldon Jackson. She's 83 years old and alive today. And others who are still here with us, they have their own stories and their own traumas and their own repeats of these ripple effects from the past. And us younger generation, I see as the healers. And Ati had mentioned the 215 children, which were, I called recovered, not discovered, because we knew they were there. It's, but when that happened, it opened the eyes of the world to pay more attention to this stain on history in other countries as well. And it opens the conversation. It opens up many things to be done. The National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, I invite people to look them up, and you can become a member of the coalition. It doesn't cost anything. Just go to the website and sign up, and you can learn many things there. So I'm grateful that we're able to be here today to share this information and start the conversation and begin more of the community healing.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much. I feel like today that we have only scratched the surface. Jamie Ann Hasselquist, Ati Nisaya, and Laura Talpe. It's a conversation we need to continue. Next week, we hope to have some additional guests to talk about the history of the Mayflower School and the larger story of intergenerational trauma caused by boarding schools and how to heal it. Thank you all for being here with us today.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for joining us for Juno Afternoon. You know, we are going to get a little bit of a taste of what's coming up at the very first fall series of Juno Jazz and Classics. And joining me now is Sandy Fortier. She's executive director of Juno Jazz and Classics to give us a preview about what is going to be the very, very, very first fall concert series for Juno Jazz and Classics. I bet you're really excited about that.
Yes, I am. It'll be just interesting to see how it goes and see how the feel is different from a spring series. And yeah, I'm excited. I'm ready.
So why did the festival decide to expand from a once a year approach in the spring?
So we've really grown over the last 35 years from a 3-day festival. And all of a sudden we were, not all of a sudden, but we've kind of gone up to be a 16-day festival. And the audience fatigue was starting to show up, and going to concerts night after night after night, which we love at a festival, but, you know, it can get expensive. And so we decided to split it so that you can go to all your concerts. And the other reason is we have a big presence in the schools, and the high schools and middle schools were requesting that we go at the beginning of the school year, and then they can apply all of the knowledge they learned from these professional music teachers for the full year. And then in the spring, we can continue with our brown bag concerts, and the elementary schools get to go and do their end of year field trips with the brown bag concerts. So it works out for all the parts of what we do.
That sounds wonderful, to bring the children into the fold of this so they can get excited about maybe the music that's going to come up in May. Well, one of the things that people wonder about is the festival expanding genres, incorporating blues. Why? I mean, why not? It seems like that jazz and classics are enough.
Yeah. It might be in a different town where we have a blues festival or bars with blues, but We give the people what they want, you know. And also these genres, blues and jazz, are very closely linked in their origins and the kinds of parts of their music, and classical too. So it is interesting how they would be related. So it's Juno, and we need professional music, and we bring professional music, and great music is great music. So we're gonna give people what they want.
Well, at the Spring Festival, it was amazing that you had the lineup that you had, Jason Vio, people that you have to typically be in a big city to go and enjoy, and here they are coming to Juno. So what can we look forward to your inaugural fall series?
So we did decide that we wanted to we're going to focus on the jazz and classics of jazz and classics. So, and then we'll give you the blues and the world music in the spring. We're going to focus in on jazz and classics. So we have the Judy Carmichael Trio for the jazz side. And she's a singer and a piano player, just a real physical piano player. She's so fun to watch. And she's bringing up a guitar player and a saxophone player. So it's a unique trio for jazz, and it's a small one, which is good for this fall festival. And then for classical, we of course have Zuhal Bailey playing cello. He's our artistic director, so he will be playing, and he recently played a concert with a violinist named Helen Kim and a pianist named Jasmine Arakawa. And it was amazing. And so he's bringing them to Juno because they just have this wonderful chemistry. So that's our classical side.
And that just sounds amazing. A lot of times you get a chance to meet up-and-coming people or people that are just entering into their prime of performance. So it's wonderful to be able to have Zuhal Bailey as the artistic director for the festival, the new one, as a matter of fact. Bringing artists that he comes in contact with. Now, I understand that beyond just sitting down and listening to these artists that you have coming, there's a chance to sit in on some workshops. How's that going to be done?
Yes. So this year we have everything, almost everything, besides the jazz workshops, but it's all at the Jack. And so the workshops will be there. The stage will be all set up. And we have workshops every time because we don't want to just bring these professional artists in, play a concert, see you later. We want them to experience how wonderful Juno is, how wonderful the people are. And we want anybody who's interested in learning more about an instrument or a type of music to be able to interact with these musicians. So we have these workshops, and we have a jazz workshop, we have a piano workshop, and a violin workshop. And you don't have to play the instrument. We have auditor slots, so you can just pay the auditor slot and you just go and watch and you see kind of how these musicians work. And if you are a very, very beginner piano player, the thing about these musicians is we pick them because they're really good teachers too, and they can immediately go to whatever level that the person is at. So I love that. And I want to just throw in here really quickly that we have scholarships for all the workshops because we really want people to get inspired.
So quickly here, what about COVID? I know people are so hungry for these one-on-one opportunities, a chance to hear a live concert. How are you navigating around that for the fall series?
We are going as overboard as we can to keep people safe, and we're following CDC guidelines in the city, and we worked with them. So we're requiring vaccine cards at the door, wear your mask, and we'll be social distanced. And then we also are setting up the chairs further from the stage than we normally would. So that's what we've got going. Some contact, we're not going to take cash. And if you buy your ticket online, now we have your list. We have a list of everyone who's coming, and so we don't have to exchange tickets. So we're doing as much as we can because there's nothing like the feeling of being live in the room with the music. And so we just got to be bold and move forward and make it happen.
Well, I know that there's a lot to take in. And so if people want to find out more, I guess your website is the best place to do that. So can you give us the web address?
Sure. It's jazzandclassics.org. And you can find the schedule. You can buy your tickets. You can get raffle tickets. It's all on there. And I'm happy to help anyway.
I know last time when Zul Bailey performed his Bach cello suites, and he did so at a very special place at the Walter Soboloff Building's Klan House, encased in that beautiful room with the wood and the acoustics, that the tickets got sold out. So how are things looking right now for your upcoming concerts?
You know, we have the Jack, and we are doing less than 50% capacity, but it is selling pretty well. We have 30 to 40 tickets left for each concert. So it's, you know, Juno is last minute, but that did come back. Like you said, it kind of came back to bite some people in the spring, especially with Zul's concert. So we have more tickets this time, but it's possible they could sell out.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Sandy Fortier with Juno Jazz and Classics. And next week on Juno Afternoon, Sandy is going to connect us with some of the performers. So we're looking forward to that, Sandy.
Yeah, me too.
All right. And for the time being, I want to play a little music from one of the performers, Judy Carmichael, performing Alligator Crawl.
Support comes from Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, providing Juno with clothing for every occasion, bonfires, weddings, casual dinner parties, and more. Online at nuggetoutfitter.com or in person at the Mendenhall Mall.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you for being here with us. Wetter and colder weather is all part of the bird migration season. And of course, there are birds that choose to stay. And we'll talk about that in today's Birds of the Week report from Brenda Wright with the Juno Audubon Society. As we always start off, Brenda, where is your bird watching addiction taking you these days?
Well, you know, pretty similar to last week. I'm still going to Eagle Beach. It's really fun to see all the birds that are passing through. There's tons of different foods there. So almost anything that's passing through, sparrows to swans might show up there. So take a look.
Okay. Sparrows to swans. That's quite a bit of diversity in size. In our Birds of the Week, it looks like we have some diversity in size. Let's start with the pine siskin, because that is a very tiny bird.
Yes, it's a little guy. It's a little bit smaller than our sparrows, not quite as small as one of the kinglets, but it is quite small. And it's very undistinctive, mostly. It's very streaked on both top and back, undersides, and it has a little bit of a yellow wing bar when it's really spiffed up.
So what are its wintering habits?
Well, you know, it's one of those birds that's eruptive, which means when they find out that there's not good food where they are, they travel together in fairly large numbers to find a place with great food. So some winters, we see them very little. And other years, we can have flocks of over 400 pine siskins all descending on the same tree to chow down.
So what do they sound like, especially when they're chowing down?
Well, you know, they sound like their frenetic traffic noise.
Okay, let's listen to this. Thank you.
Our next bird is a bird that most people would probably say sounds annoying. The black-billed magpie, you know, sort of like your mother nagging you to make your bed in the morning when you were a kid.
Yep. The black-billed magpie, especially in winter, likes to be in groups, and it likes every person in the group, every bird, to know exactly where it is. Yap, yap, yap.
Okay. So we got a sample of the yap, yap, yapping. So what do you think we should know about the black-billed magpie? Is it a year-round resident?
No, not for Juno. It's a very easy bird to identify, though, because it's as big as the Steller's Jay, and it's black and white and has a huge tail. So if you see a bird yapping away, flying across the road, black and white, that is your magpie.
Okay. Now, our next bird is the white-winged crossbill. What type of bird is this?
They're very interesting to look at. The crossbill means the upper one is over the lower one, so that when they pry into a cone to eat, they spring the seed right out into their mouth. It has a more melodious sound, and it talks a lot. So since they spend all their time on the highest, tallest trees that we have, it's nice to know where to try to look for them. And the male is red and the female not.
So chances are you're going to hear this bird then if it's perched at the top of trees eating.
Yes, and they do like to be in small groups, and they flit around a bit. So once you hear them, you can just start staring at the very tops and hope to get to see them in your binoculars.
Okay, so let's listen. So the bird watching season, does it wind down as we head towards winter?
You know, it doesn't really so much because we have so many birds that overwinter here. Because our tidal system keeps the wetlands free of ice and snow, there's a huge smorgasbord every day at low tide. So we have lots and lots of birds and ducks that like to spread across the wetlands to eat.
So that keeps you busy then during the winter.
Yep, we're pretty lucky. Christmas bird count, we almost always have at least 70 species here.
All right, well, thank you very much, Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Gunach Chish. Hope everyone has a great weekend and a great evening.